It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You've probably heard many times these terms far right, radical right, and alt-right. But what do they mean? What's the difference? These movements are still relatively new, and little to no research exists about them. Kes Mudd has shed some light on these groups. He has a new book out called The Far Right in America. He's a professor in the Department of International Affairs at the University of Georgia and joins me now from Athens. Hi, Kes.
Hi, Celeste.
Let's define these terms first, if we can, beginning with the difference between far right, right wing, and radical right.
Yeah, well, far right is used as kind of a container concept where all the groups that on the one hand think that inequality should be left alone by the state are together, and on the other hand, there are both extreme groups that don't believe in democracy at all, so they don't believe that the people should elect its own leaders, and radical right, who do believe that the people should elect their own leaders, but who have problems with specific aspects of what we call liberal democracy, most notably rule of law and minority rights.
Now, we're talking about sort of the extreme, in many cases, the fringes of politics, are we not? I mean, that exists in both the left side of politics and the right side. Is that fair?
Yes, we have an extreme left and a radical left, and we have an extreme right and a radical right. The extreme right is fringes of politics, both in Europe and in North America. But the radical right is much closer to the mainstream. The point is that within the U.S., you don't have a specific radical right party like you have in Europe. And as a consequence, it has to operate within the two-party system.
So your research focuses on the radical right, and you worked on this topic for 15 years in Europe before you moved to the U.S. So what differences, besides what you just talked about, the fact that there's no sort of centralized power over the far right in the U.S., what other differences are there?
Well, one of the most important things is we look so much at parties that as a consequence, if we don't see it dominating a specific party, we think it isn't there. And that makes the radical right in the U.S. much more difficult to see because to a certain extent, it is within individuals within the existing party, most notably the Republican Party, people like Steve King from Iowa, or Louis Gohmert, or it is at the state level. The other thing is that in the U.S., a lot of politics is at the grassroots level, and I think in that is something that we often see as unorganized and therefore less ideological.
So this, I assume, is why you say in your book there's a lack of serious scholarship on this topic. And is that because of what you just said, that they're not necessarily associated with a specific political party?
Yes, it's much easier to study political parties, right? Because they go to elections and it's very easy to find the score that they have. And then you can compare those things and they tend to have websites, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas when you have a movement like the Tea Party, which is very disorganized, which is doesn't have a clear leadership, which is spread all over the country, it requires a lot of resources, time, to study them. And that is obviously more difficult and less rewarding often.
But one of the things we have found, especially recently during what I can only describe as sort of explosive growth in militias and far-right groups, is that law enforcement takes these groups pretty seriously, even though they're not associated with a specific political party. Going back to 2009, you write about the report from Homeland Security on right-wing extremism. We have seen a number of similar reports from law enforcement talking about the danger of these groups. So why is there a disconnect between what the warnings we're hearing from law enforcement and scholarship on the topic?
Yeah, that's quite surprising because, as said, particularly in law enforcement, they have long been worried about militia movements and more recently about so-called sovereign citizens who don't accept any type of authority beyond the county level. And law enforcement sees that as a serious threat and actually as the most important domestic terror threat. Within academia, it's studied less in part because these groups are very badly organized. They're also generally not very open to scholars, and they're just really difficult to find. The other thing is that the media and the general debate is much more focused on the really extreme outsider groups. So we talk endlessly about the alt-right, even though if you look at the violence potential of the sovereign citizens is far, far bigger than that of the alt-right.
So another thing you mentioned in there, and you draw some chronological timelines back to Birth of a Nation and the movements that inspired, and you say we underestimate the influence on the arts on these movements. Why do you think the arts are so powerful?
Well, I think that politics is generally an expression of a broader culture, and so to make a successful movement, you have to attach your program to the broader cultural values. And so if you look at, for example, the rise of the second Klan in the 1920s, then that has clearly been influenced in Birth of a Nation, which portrayed the original Klan in a very favorable light. But if you look at the broader culture in the U.S., then aspects of populism in which the heartland between the two coasts, and in which the people are pure and in which the elites and the cities are bad, you see that in all kinds of essays, going back to Mark Twain, Common Sense, going back to Jimmy Stewart's movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, or even in country music and harmless movies like Sweet Home Alabama.
So another thing that you say that is a bit of a danger is the confusion of extremism and radicalism. And we so often hear those words used interchangeably. Why is that wrong?
Because they're different threats. And so one of the problems is when you say that everything is a Nazi, that obviously Nazism is a major threat. Like, it's responsible for the killing of millions and millions of people. And if you call, for example, Donald Trump a Nazi, then the only thing that Donald Trump has to do is to show that he's not a Nazi, which really isn't that hard, right? Because
right.
He doesn't want to kill 6 million Jews. But at the same time, it makes it look that as long as you're not a Nazi, you're fine for liberal democracy. But actually, there are many different ways in which you can be problematic for liberal democracy without being a Nazi. And so it's important to see what the threat actually is and to be measured in the description, but also be clear that even if you don't want to kill all kind of people, there's still a problem with your conception of what is society and what is a democracy.
So where do you fall on this argument of, you talk about how the far right was marginalized in decades past, especially in the South. And I wonder whether you think many people argue we should actually bring them further in so that people can hear what those views are, that those conversations actually need to open up, that we need to stop avoiding these conversations and hear from these people directly. Where do you fall on that particular debate?
Well, I'm an extreme free speecher, and therefore I believe that everyone should be allowed to say everything. On the other hand, free speech doesn't mean that every individual outlet gives a voice to people. And so I think that public institutions should let everyone speak. I also think that with free speech comes also the freedom to criticize. And so if someone says racist things, we have also a right to say that they say racist things. But it is important to have everyone say what they really mean, because that's the only way that we can actually address that issue. That doesn't mean that I believe that I can be in a debate with convinced like alt-right, so-called white supremacists like Richard Spencer, and we have a rational debate and he will see his errors and become a liberal Democrat. That's not how it works.
That's Cass Mutta. He's professor in the Department of International Affairs at UGA. His new book is called The Far Right in America. Always a pleasure, Cass. Thank you.
Thank you very much.